I'm so excited that there are so many people here. And just a quick note to the candidates. I'm Melissa Epstein. I was the one that sent the email on behalf of APAC to invite you tonight. So glad that you guys could join us when an adult starts talking, of course, appears the child. And we just so you guys know, when we have a candidate forum every 2 years, this is usually our most well-attended meeting of the whole year. So this is a very engaged audience. And Kate will go over the format a little bit more when we've got everybody in, but it should be a really good night. So we're very, very happy that you're here to talk about special education in Ann Arbor.
Should we get started?
Let's
Are we
get
good? Okay.
started. So this is the first meeting of the 22-23 school year. It's hard to say that out loud. It just seems like time is flying. The Ann Arbor Parent Advisory Committee for Special Education is the district-wide parent group. It's a group of the board that represents the interests of students who have disabilities, who have IEPs or 504 plans, special education or disability accommodations in Ann Arbor Public Schools. We meet regularly with the administrators and report directly to the board as frequently as we can. And we welcome you all tonight. I'm going to introduce Kate Wright, who is a former co-chair of the APAC board, but we couldn't let her run away too fast. She agreed to moderate tonight's forum. Hand it over to you, Kate. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Right, this is my parting gift to the board for a little bit. I'll be back later. But we are, so there's so many candidates. We are so happy that there are so many candidates. I think it's really a great expression of this community, and this town. So, but because of that, we want to stick within our 2 hour time limit, and we're going to be pretty strict with time. So that's why Melissa asked for your bios. So I'll read the bios so everybody has their introduction to you before we do the questions. So we've given you three questions. You've all seen them. And we're going to be asking for your answers. We know that our audience is going to have questions too. And so audience, we're asking you to put them into the chat. And we will keep track of those questions. What we're going to do is sort of at the end of today's meeting, we're going to take the chat transcript and compile the questions, email them out to you again. So candidates have an opportunity to respond to those questions, and we will post, we'll pull that all together. We'll post it on our website, and then we'll publicize the fact that that information is on our website through our social media, channels. Okay, so that's the best we thought we could do to have real communication and back and forth, but also, keep things moving. I'm going to go up and down the alphabet. So I'm going to start by going down the alphabet to introduce. And then when I ask the first question, I'm going to go back up and then, so if you're like in the middle, you're just always going to be in the middle. Okay. So I'm going to get started if I can find my screen. And okay. So starting at the top of the alphabet, Suzanne Basquette. She's dedicated 19 years of service to our. Sorry, I still have to arrange my screen a little bit. Go. To our students, to some of her goals have been to keep our students safe. She's fought guns on student on school properties, school vouchers, and banning books. She's a graduate of AAPS, U of M, and Duke University. Kai Cortona, you'll notice, is not here. She needs to be with family at this moment. I don't know. Jamila James, is she here? I just didn't see. Well, her bio is that she does not believe we are preparing children for the future. We are not supporting them for adulthood. She believes in equity, social emotional learning, mental health, and social work support. All of our babies are important and deserve a fighting chance. Lena Kaufman, is it Lena or Lena? Did I say it?
Lena.
Lena. Okay. Lena Kaufman is a writer and an editor in healthcare communication. She's a parent of three children in the Ann Arbor Public Schools and a passionate advocate for ensuring public school children have in-person education and the restoration of pre-pandemic services, including before and after care, child care.
They have very positive things.
Good.
Jeremy. Jeremy Lapham is a long-term Ann Arbor resident, a single parent of a third and a sixth grader in this AAPS schools, and a school-based nurse practitioner. He's also a first-generation college student, community college graduate, and holds two master's degrees from U of M, current vice president of the U of M Nurses Union. Rima Mohammed is a first-generation refugee Palestinian American who has lived through financial, social, and emotional struggles. The support she had from public schools is one major reason why she wants to give back to schools and to serve the community, especially the vulnerable. She's passionate about addressing DEIA, transparency, and curriculum. I was just told to slow down. I'm sorry. You can tell I'm real nervous about time. Barry Schumer, I had a note that he was late, so we'll see if he's there. Is a clinical social worker and psychotherapist with 23 years experience in the public schools. He's the author of 7 books, including In Defense of Teachers, and he's running for the school board because he loves the city and wants to serve his community. Andrew Spencer, a scientist, has 2 kids attending AAPS and is married to a pediatrician from Mott Children's Hospital. He was raised by public school teachers in Michigan. His mom was a special education director, and his brother is also a public school educator and taught special education for the last 10 years. Suzanne Ward Schmidt is a lifelong special education teacher who has spent her career advocating for children to receive the services and support they need to succeed both academically and personally, a mission she will continue to work for as an Ann Arbor School Board member. Leslie Wilkins is a 14-year AAPS parent. Serving on the board has been in her heart for a long time. She spent 8 years on school PTOs and other nonprofits. With degrees in music, psychology, and business, she works full-time in marketing. Leslie wants to help all students thrive. Alex Wood is a queer Jewish Puerto Rican mom with explicit pro-mask vaccines and unions, queer and trans-affirming, anti-racist, and disability justice-focused platform. Her 25 years working with local families and nonprofits shows commitment to the kind of equity and justice work needed now at Ann Arbor Public Schools. I saw a note. So that is everybody's bio that we had. Jacinta Townsend sent a chat. She wasn't able to send a bio. Do you want to take 1 minute to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Hi, my name is Jacinta Townsend Guidis. I'm a parent of 2 kids in AAPS, one of whom has a 504. I have a BA from Harvard, a JD from Duke, and an MFA from the Iowa Writers Workshop. And I'm a novelist who teaches in it at UM.
Thank you. Great. Very efficient. Okay. So our first question, we're going to start with Alex Wood. And I'm going to call your name to move to the next person. And I am going to time you for 2 minutes so I'll cut you off if you go over. But our first question is, APAC's recent work with AAPS has emphasized the intersectionality of kids with IEPs and 504s, as well as the importance of thinking about disability when we discuss diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. Kids with IEPs and 504s, like the rest of us, have intersectional identities. They are different genders, have varying racial and ethnic backgrounds, are wealthy or working class, yet often their label of educational disability becomes the most important thing about them. Sometimes the only thing that people seem to care about in school. How do you see disability as part of DEI initiatives? And what concrete steps can you offer in that direction? So starting Alex Wood.
Thanks. In addition to holding multiple other marginalized identities, I'm also disabled myself. This includes a learning disability that was diagnosed during my time at Ann Arbor Public Schools and for which I received little to no support and significant stigma. I'm intimately aware of how this plays out in our schools. There's a lot of work to be done at Ann Arbor Public Schools to combat both structural ableism and the interpersonal. I have a colleague at U of M who specializes in disability justice work. They currently provide sensitivity trainings to local hospitals, mental health care centers, and educators, and would be eager to come to our schools for teacher and staff trainings. Comprehensive training for our staff is a great start to accomplishing this. From there, implementing universal design for learning creates a more equitable learning environment so students, regardless of family access to what is often an expensive diagnosis process, are ensured access to accommodations. Another important piece of this will be having someone on board leadership who understands firsthand how to recognize when ableism is at play and who is committed to prioritizing our disabled students' access needs and inclusion.
Great, thank you. Leslie Wilkins.
I see disability as part of DEIA. I add the A because I want to include anti-racism in two ways. First, as a distinct identity, and secondly, in the intersectionality that the question refers to. While all students benefit from DEIA initiatives, they benefit in different degrees according to their different level of need for support. A white, straight, cisgender student with wealthy parents, if they have a learning disability, is still going to need special attention to make sure their opportunities are equitable and make sure they're represented, make sure they see other kids like them in books, materials, and other curriculum. However, a student who is Black or lesbian or has food insecurity, who also has a learning disability, is going to need different methods to make sure their opportunities are equitable and make sure all their various identities are represented in books and other learning materials. What's most important is that each student is seen, that each student feels valued, and that each student gets an opportunity to thrive. One of the concrete steps I can offer is a commitment to go to the source, to ask the families who are directly affected about what they think would make a difference in their kids' learning experiences, and then following up after those changes have been implemented to make sure they're having the positive impact we're working toward.
Thank you. Susan Wortschmidt.
Hi, good evening. First of all, I want to honor all of you in attendance tonight that advocate for your children every day. It's a difficult job that at times can seem hopeless. I've advocated for kids my whole life, and I feel your struggles. I've been fortunate since I retired in 2019 to work with MIPAC. It's a statewide organization many of you know about that help parents know their rights in advocating for their children. Side by side with them and coalitions around the state, I've worked with Heather Eckner, Senator Irwin, to try to move legislation through our legislature that will better identify kids with reading problems and making sure teachers have what they need to help those kids. As a lifelong teacher, particularly in my work with students with learning disabilities, my mission has been focused on celebrating each child's individuality and to give each child what they need to succeed. I've tried to see the world through their eyes, their challenges, their hardships, their frustrations, their victories and accomplishments, and have worked to understand how best to support these students and their families. I've been intentional in obtaining the additional training over the years to better serve my students so they can thrive and succeed. In my eyes, we need to work together to create safe and accepting classrooms that celebrate each child's individuality and to make sure teachers have the adequate training to support all students. We need to do this collectively to create an equitable learning environment for all kids. Thank you.
Thanks. Jacinta?
Thank you. Yeah, I love the question. And I love what Leslie said about the A at the end of DEI should include anti-racism, because that does speak to the heart. A lot of intersectionality issues that happen, for instance, we know that Black children are often over-identified for special education, but also I'm including that A to include accessibility and to take a look at who has access and who doesn't. We know that in the state of Michigan and in APS, a lot of students don't get access. It's very hard often to get the 504, to get the IEP, you know, and also to speak to the part of the question about the labeling sometimes becoming the most important thing about children who do manage to get the IEPs and 504s. You know, I'm an educator myself. I often get accommodation letters. But what I never get is any training about differentiation in the classroom. So I have students who are from, they range from students who are stimming in class to students who need trigger warnings on the material. And I would love, you know, if elected, to do that for teachers in our district, to give a lot more professional development about differentiation, because we're not pulling out, we're pushing in. And what you do when you push in is to offer a lot more sort of instructional diversity for students who need that sort of accessibility. And yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thanks. Andy Spencer.
Thanks very much, and thanks for hosting this event. I think it's central to how we think about diversity. For me, this question evokes the history of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act itself, which on its surface appreciates the individuality of people, and we can't lose sight of that, you know, decades on from its passing. It needs to be central to how we think about this for individual students. In some districts, for example, in rural districts like where I grew up, students with IEPs and 504 plans can make up the majority of diverse learners in a district. So it is one aspect of the diversity we have of learning in schools. That's not the case in Ann Arbor, because we have a diversity across multiple axes in our community, which is a strength for our district. It just makes it a challenge for us to make sure we don't lose sight of that when we think about individual students with IEPs and 504 plans. You know, there are multiple examples in our country's history that we can point to where we've failed to treat others the way that we would want to be treated, or the way that we would want our students and kids to be treated. And failing to actively provide special education resources to all students that incorporate their individual histories and their individual needs was certainly one of those examples. So we need to try to avoid instances when students are identified as special education due to, say, language issues, language learning issues, which has happened as part of my mom's career, or in situations where behaviors are interpreted differently depending on the race or gender of a particular student in exhibiting the behaviors, which my brother has seen in his career. So in short, I view disability and the associated educational issues as an important aspect of our DEI efforts at the district, you know, and making that explicit within both our strategic plan and our teacher training efforts makes a lot of sense to me.
Thanks. Barry Schumer, are you here now? All right. Rima Mohammed. Rima.
Yeah, thank you so much for this invitation. And this is a very, very important question. As a child and an adult with a disability, and now a child newly diagnosed with a disability, I think this is, you know, definitely I'll be reaching out to this group a lot more. But one of my priorities is to address DEIA issues and inequities facing our schools. And it is crucial to include students with disabilities as part of the plan. As a trustee, I want to include addressing and analyzing inequities and opportunity gaps in education, again, especially in kids with disability. I think some of these gaps that we really have to look at, as Jacinda mentioned about accessibility, that's a huge barrier. Affordability. So sometimes students can't get everything throughout the schools. Are there things, you know, we need to make sure that we work with community partners to make sure services are available for students with disabilities. And then other barriers that a lot of people don't usually think about, but language barriers, cultural barriers, and socioeconomic factors. I plan to analyze and address these gaps in education and ensure consistency throughout the district. And then again, looking at things such as student learning and learning loss, teacher resources and professional development, student resources supports, and the types of assessments we use and other factors, as I mentioned. So hopefully look at those. Thank you.
Thanks. Just to confirm, Paulette Metoyer, are you here? Okay. We'll go to Jeremy Lapham.
Hi, thank you. So as a parent of a student with a 504 and an IEP and having advanced degrees, I had a hard time understanding the process, what's allowed, what's not allowed. And I can only imagine with somebody who works in schools or works with people and patients and families with the types of conditions that would lead one to have an IEP. If I'm having a hard time understanding it, I imagine a lot of other parents are also having a problem understanding the process. So one of the things I would advocate for are parent education programs that would allow parents to learn what the process entails of how IEPs work, how to self-advocate, both for the students and for the parents. But a bigger issue and something I think that we have a bigger potential role in as board members is looking at the people who are providing the care. They are often the most represented groups in our society. So we have a lot of women, women of color, men of color providing care as paraprofessionals. We don't give them good pay. They do not have access to getting a lot of continuing education or opportunities for extra education, whether that be time or money or whatever. And that's something that as a board, we could advocate for and encourage the administration to allocate funding to. There's a lot of other things that are out there. And I think a lot of people would agree on things like ending segregation and restraint policies, aggressive enforcement of 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, the American Disabilities Act, and the integration mandate of the Olmstead decision. And just ending seclusion and restraint is a really big thing. It's still happening in our schools. And a big part of that is because the people who are providing the day-to-day hands-on care, I don't think they're necessarily well trained. And that's from speaking with them. They want to learn these skills. They want to learn the knowledge. They want to get the behaviors. So that's where I would start. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Lena Kaufman, let's go to you.
Hi, good evening. Thank you so much for having me and letting me have this opportunity to speak to all of you and be with these excellent other candidates who are running for school board. When it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion, I feel it's absolutely critical that special ed students and students of varying abilities be included in that process. And it's not just for the students. It's not just for the parents, it's for our whole community. Diversity, equity, and inclusion really begins in our schools where we're teaching our children on how to live in a diverse society and have an open mind to all different people from all different backgrounds, from all different abilities. When we carve out IEP and 504 as like a separate concern from DEI, we do our schools a disservice and we do our whole society a disservice. While school board can speak in favor of including disability in DEI work, it's not helpful if it's purely performative without any reporting requirements on the district to show progress over the years. DEI work is not a one and done. It's an ongoing effort of continuing process and progress improvement going back years and years and years. As a school board trustee, I would hope to work with the AAPS administration, special education staff, and of course, parents on setting clear written goals that should be updated regularly to the community to show progress or lack thereof in this regard, including, of course, for students that may fall into multiple categories of diversity.
Thank you. Jamila James, is she here? Okay. And so Susan Basquette.
Thank you. So first, let me apologize for the obvious hurt that's been embedded in this question. This experience has not been brought to my attention as a trustee, nor am I familiar with the child's disability overshadowing the child's race or other attributes. My brother and I receive special education services for our speech and hearing, and I foster parented a younger cousin with fetal alcohol effect, and I've had my son evaluated twice for special ed services. Never at any one time were we made to feel that our race or cultural heritage or background was forgotten. It never was overshadowed. The district's DEI and now diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility, as has been announced at a previous board, is to be what it states, inclusive. The staff has included students and with disabilities in their work. I mean, they've even had a graphic on it as part of the presentation. So they're not forgotten. Leaders of the PAC, Ann Arbor PAC, they used to remind us board members often that at any one time, each of us could quickly become someone living with a disability. So that was a reminder of what could happen. A few concrete steps that I would say to include is, first of all, expecting all students to be represented and to hear of the impact of the DEIA work on their educational experience. I will continue to ask questions for clarity on any issues and to hold the staff accountable as a community holds us trustees accountable. And I'll also ask that the PAC come back to us on a monthly basis to, again, give us progress and areas of how we may improve. Again, the monthly reviews that we were given in the past were very helpful, and hopefully post-COVID we'll continue to hear from you. Thank you.
Thanks. So that was our first question. We're going to go to our second, and we're going to start at the top and work our way down. So Susan's going to talk to us again. And here it is. It's also in the chat. If you could make one policy change within your purview as trustee to how AAPS implements special education, what would that be and why? So Susan,
thank
go ahead.
You. Well, thank you. And thank you for the question, because people don't often understand. Special education services are heavily regulated by the government. So we as trustees don't have too much influence, if you will, regarding the policies. There's not too much that we can change. However, in terms of practice, I would offer three suggestions. First of all, I would insist that families who are learning English or are struggling with English, that an interpreter or translator be offered and no meetings be held without them present. This helps everybody understand what's being discussed, to also address questions or concerns, as well as to add comfort to the families and reducing tension so that we can build trust moving forward. Secondly, for all families, I highly advise that parents and caregivers have a supportive advocate present with them at the IEP meetings or any educational performance reviews. IEP meetings can cause high anxiety for some family members. I've experienced that. When tensions are high, trust is low, and hearing and understanding go awry. Questions may be forgotten or dismissed. Or deemed just not important. So while well-intentioned, sometimes staff forgets that not everybody speaks their language of special ed, if you will, or in terms of acronyms. And so an advocate could help us through that process. Regardless of income or education, my experience has been that even the most simple terms can be misunderstood or misinterpreted. So having that advocate can help to check if the parent or caregiver is heard and understands and feels supportive. And thirdly, parents and caregivers, I always say take notes, write everybody's name down, everybody's title, so that this could help for future understanding or to clarify anything later. Thank you.
Thanks. Nina, to you.
So I want to start by commending Trustee Baskett for something that happened before the pandemic. In 2018, Ann Arbor Public Schools hired Hanover, a leading research and analytics firm, to study and recommend improvements in how the district delivers special education services. The district paid Hanover over $100,000 for its analysis, which included focus groups with teachers and parents, and made research-backed recommendations to the AAPS leadership. The draft report, unfortunately, though, came out right before the pandemic hit, and was not published. And an update was not given until this year. We're now 4 years out from this original study. If I could make one policy change, I would advocate for a little less board time on promotional videos and getting back to some of this hard work, such as getting regular updates on our progress on the things identified in the Hanover report for special ed. Every special ed family needs to have the security that the services that they're getting in their school building are the same high quality services that they would find at any school building across the district. And what concerned me in the Hanover report was why that was one of their concerns, that there was a little too much variability between buildings. And that's an area I think that definitely the board, it can't tell the district what to do, but it can hold the district accountable on regular reports from its work that it's already started. So thank you.
Thanks. To Lapham.
Sure, thank you. So again, I would go back to the recruitment and retention of quality paraprofessionals, including access to professional development and training, and also hiring of non-ABA based practitioners. That's really all I think that I'll keep it short and simple because we got a long slate. So that's what I would want to do. The practitioners are asking for it and are ready for it. And that's one of the things I think I would advocate for the most. So thank you.
Thanks. Rima Mohammed.
Yeah. One policy change that I'd want to look at, and this is not just, you know, specifically for students in special education or with disabilities, but really to look at the assessments we use to assess student learning. I understand that there are requirements by the state about having these required summative assessments, and we use MSTEP and other standardized tests, but we know that these tests can be biased against certain groups of individuals, especially people of color, students with disability, and low income groups. So, and I know that there's a, you know, I'm an educator too, but primarily with graduate students, and I know there's accommodations that can be made, but standardized testing can be very stressful. So I would love to be innovative and leaders in assessing, you know, achievement or learning, and focus on assessments that are integrated as part of the school curriculum and making these assessments more relatable to students. And I think that would help also support students with disabilities as well. Thank you.
Thanks. I think Barry Schumer is here now, if you want to answer this question.
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can. Go ahead.
Good. Very good. Okay. So I guess I'd start out with a compliment to special ed teachers, and the retention of great special ed professional teachers is very important. I worked for 23 years in the public schools in special ed as a clinical social worker, went to hundreds and hundreds of IEPs. Overall, special ed staff throughout the state of Michigan, for sure in Ann Arbor, do an incredible job with students, very sensitive to the students' needs, any ways they can grow academically, emotionally, and very sensitive to the parents' needs, because obviously a parent with a child with a disability, especially a severe disability, very emotional, very difficult issues, a lot of grief issues. So overall, I think the staffs have done an excellent job. I would say as far as an advocate at meetings, sometimes that is necessary because the parent really needs that support. I believe that in the majority of cases with IEPs, an advocate is not necessary, but understand the recommendation for parents taking notes and understanding what's going on for sure. But overall, like I say, no major changes. I think we're doing a great job for kids and parents in special education.
Thanks. Andy.
Thank you. I'm not an expert in special education delivery or as a parent. I can only leverage what I've learned talking to parents in the district and talking with my mom and brother who've spent so many years in special ed. I would echo Trustee Basquiat's comments related to the fact that this area of education is highly regulated. But when I think about this and when I've talked to parents in our district, what they ask me in regard to how to make their life better for their student and them is that I would like us to make a solid commitment to parents in the district to provide before and after school care for our working family. This group has pointed out to the board that the decision to suspend those services for a period of time had a huge negative impact on many, many parents, caregivers, and students in our school community. And in addition, the prolonged lack of in-person learning, which by itself was also deeply felt in many families of students with IEPs and 504 plans. Several parents I've spoken to about this have communicated that they had an increasing feeling of desperation during that time as that remote learning went on for longer than any of us first imagined it would. So there were real impacts. So policy-wise, as I've stated on my website since the campaign started, I would like to see the district be committed to before and after school care for our working families, particularly those families and students for whom it is most impactful. And beyond that, as a board member, I would not support any public health mandates that go beyond those that the public health experts at Washtenaw County and the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services put in place, because I want to make sure that we're in person as much as we possibly can going forward. I think that's best for students on IEPs and 504 plans.
Thanks. Jacinta.
Yes, great question. So I think, you know, first and foremost, and most of all, we have great people on the building level. We have great parents, great teachers. But at the level of SISS itself, often no response, poor response, untimely response. I think, you know, I remember when I was getting my kids 504, I got it actually in a different state. I got it in California. But, you know, one of the huge things is that when we did a 504 meeting, every single teacher was at the meeting. Every single teacher was at that meeting with us. And that's key, because everyone needed to know what she needed, what accommodations, how she was performing and everything. That doesn't necessarily happen at AAPS. I understand there are, you know, problems in terms of coverage, but that's something that SISS should be coordinating. And I think in general, when I hear from parents that, you know, we called SISS and they didn't call us back, or we emailed them, they didn't email us back, like, that's unacceptable to me. That happens a lot in AAPS, unfortunately, and I won't go into other areas where that happens. But, you know, we have this top-heavy administrative system at Ballas, and meanwhile, I'm seeing paras who are doing amazing work. As a board member, I would just question the top-heaviness, you know, why we need administrators who aren't returning phone calls or emails. I think I agree we need to recruit and retain a lot more paras, a lot more special education professionals, a lot more people who have training. And I want to resist the idea that a board can't do that. When I was a board member, I was on my district's high ability committee. And as you know, that's one of the 13 areas of special education. And we implemented procedures to integrate the program, identify more Title I students for the program. It made a huge difference. So, you know, I was never a board member who rubber stamped what a district told me to do.
To stick to our timeline, but thank you. I think we've got Susan. Ward Schmidt.
Yes. I'm particularly interested in improving the effectiveness of using valid and reliable assessments that inform instruction and interventions. Currently, an inordinate amount of time is spent on required, standardized, and other tests that generate data that is of little use to teachers and interventionists to plan instruction to help their students. There are mandates that come down from the state, but school districts can pick and choose from lists to find those that are scientifically relevant and will help our teachers instruct with that information. These assessments steal precious instructional time from our children. In addition to being more effective at identifying what it is that students need for support, there needs to be high quality professional learning that's easily accessible for staff. there's money right now available at the state level for teachers to sign up for Orton-Gillingham training, for intensive literacy training. It's a matter of making sure teachers know they're available, teachers can sign up, and they just need coverage. This training needs to include building knowledge about evidence-based instructional practices grounded in peer-reviewed research, not what the textbook companies are telling you, but what the science tells us. This is particularly needed in literacy. I've seen over my career, and while teaching at Scarlett Middle School and tutoring students that attend AAPS, this is an issue that needs serious attention. We currently have parents across the district spending thousands of dollars seeking private tutoring because students are not being supported in a way that results in positive outcomes. It's especially important following a period of interrupted learning our kids have experienced, where students with learning challenges have fallen farther and farther behind. We should all feel a sense of urgency, especially with our youngest learners, as we know early intervention gives us the best chance to make a difference. At the same time, though, we must be vigilant to support our older students with the supports they need to become independent learners. Thank you.
Thanks. Leslie, we'll go to you.
Thanks. My base knowledge in this area is mostly from hearing my parents discuss situations over the dinner table. My mom was a school psychologist and my dad was a middle school science teacher. In preparing for this forum, I did what I intend to do with just about everything policy related on the school board. I asked AAPS families about their experiences. In talking to parents and caregivers about their kids with IEPs and 504s, the one thing I heard most often, and Jeremy Lapham spoke to this a little bit, was the fear that they might be missing something that would make a big difference for their child. They don't know what they don't know, and when it comes to their kids' learning experience, that can be terrifying. Also, there's a genuine sense of urgency, like Susan just talked about, with the timing of all this, because the longer it takes to get support and accommodations in place, the more and more frustrated your kid is getting, and the more work you're going to have to do to shift that student back to once again enjoying the learning experience. I don't know how we would implement this exactly, although I think a few others on the Zoom call could figure it out. But I think just a comprehensive list of what the options are would be super helpful to parents. Kind of like the Amazon shopping thing when it says people who bought this also bought the following items. This would be a students who asked for extra time with written exams also asked for these accommodations. It doesn't mean all kids would need all the things on the list, but I think it would empower parents and caregivers to know what all the options are, so they can spend time making decisions about what's best for their child rather than spending that time making sure they're not missing something. So that's one idea I had.
Thanks. Alex Wood is going to get a chance, and then Jamila, if you're ready to answer question number two, we'll go to you, okay, before we go to question three. Go ahead, Alex.
Thanks. I talk about this one a lot because I believe it's the most important way forward to a truly inclusive and equitable learning environment, not just for our kids with diagnosed disabilities, but for the ones whose disabilities will go unnoticed or undiagnosed, something more likely for our students experiencing other forms of marginalization, like poverty and racism. My plan is to work toward implementing universal design for learning across our schools. Our kids' learning environment and curriculum needs to be built as inclusive as possible as the default from the beginning, not added back in piece by piece later. So many of the accommodations parents have to push for, like having alternatives for auditory or visual information or ensuring access to assistive technology, and even just access to the bathroom, should all be standard practice, not something we have to fight for accessing. So many of our kids' disabilities will be discovered or diagnosed later in life, and these universal accommodations shift the learning environment so that everyone can access them regardless of a family's ability to afford a diagnosis. Shifting the culture so that accommodations are seen as the standard also paves the way for more specialized accommodations to be honored and respected by the staff needed to implement them. Thanks.
I was muted. Jamila, did you see the question? Or would you like me to read it? I'm not sure when you came in.
Could you please repeat it?
Sure. If you could make one policy change within your purview as trustee to how AAPS implements special education, what would that be and why?
So I will make the Office of Special Education, which was previously called the SIS, accountable for services that's not being implemented. I've noticed that often if you can get an IEP done, that the implementation of it is really sketchy sometimes, especially during COVID. The funds are federally mandated, available. And although I understand that staffing comes into play with some of these issues, I believe that if accountability came more into play, a lot of these issues will become more of a priority. I would have us use our community resources as well to help us out to get these accommodations on track. I would also like to address the way families are dropped off the program despite the needs of the child based on standardized tests. Some other technical reasons. The written word is not more important than our kids. We are here to do the actual work and help our babies, not just check a box and get the funding. If we're not here to help them all succeed, what are we here for? I think that it's very important that teachers are supported in doing this. I know that it added an extra workload to them to be able to do the accommodation, but I'm also a firm believer that these can be incorporated at everyday things, the accommodations such as doing things like with play and with integrating with other children. So I think that there's just have to be a will to actually do the work and get it done and stop othering our children with special abilities, special education, because all of us are having issues. All of our children have a neurologic diversion. It's said that one out of six children have some type of diversions. So this is not a speciality. This is not a normal thing. This is something that is our reality today, and we need to address it accordingly.
Thanks. All right. Okay. That was our last answer for question number two. I'm going to go to question three, and I'm going to go backwards up the alphabet again. So we're going to start with Alex, with you. And my third question is, one of the tenets of IDEA is that parent participation is key to developing a good IEP and supporting children to learn in the least restrictive environment. Yet many parents are frustrated with their child services, and some parents feel that they are not treated as equal partners in the IEP process. What systemic fixes can you propose to better ensure collaboration with families to achieve the best outcomes for students?
Thanks. I believe universal design for learning will make a big difference here too. If we incorporate some of the most frequently requested accommodations as a standard school practice, that frees up a lot of the staff's bandwidth to devote to working together with parents to facilitate other more specific accommodations. It's difficult for me to imagine a scenario where the accommodations are being denied or resisted without the tacit support of the administration, an unspoken policy that has perpetuated a culture of ableism at Ann Arbor Public Schools. This culture could be changed with an actual disabled person on the board who will openly advocate for our kids and be unwilling to allow that to continue. The administration's hand in preventing the district from following through on its legal obligation to honor these documents is a real concern of mine. In my 25 years working with local families, often with disabled kids and parents, I have never known one who didn't need to hire a lawyer to force our schools to honor their IEP. And I've known several for whom that was not an option. And so they simply left the district or chose to homeschool. Parents and teachers are often pitted against each other. But if the teachers had been given the support that they needed and a clear mandate from the administration that working hand in hand with parents and fulfilling IEP obligations is a normal and expected piece of the way we run our schools, this could all be managed in a way that is better for everyone, especially our kids. Another important piece of this is also the fact that ableism is still one of the most socially acceptable forms of bigotry. This affects everyone's attitudes towards necessary accommodations and their willingness to support them. I believe that staff, given the support and direction they need from the top down and given training to combat internalized ableism, will be significantly easier to work with as a team with our parents to accommodate our kids' needs. Thanks.
Thank you. Leslie.
This is an interesting question. Some of the families I spoke with seem to have the opposite problem. They feel like there's too much left to the parents doing and not enough guidance or intervention from counselors and other staff. Now, the parents I talked to are amazing. They're doing all the research. They spend all their waking hours advocating for their child until they get the accommodations they need. But I kept thinking about the families who don't have that luxury of time, or families with language barriers, like Rima spoke about, where it's going to be much harder to do the research. This goes back to the issue of equity, where we need to make sure all families are considered when implementing policies and procedures. There needs to be a way to intentionally reach out to families who are affected, ask about their experiences, collaborate with them on solutions, and then again, follow up with them to make sure the solutions are having the intended outcomes. I also think a lot of this has to do with the individual teacher, counselor, or staff member. For the record, the staff at Pittsfield and Scarlett sound incredible. If my kid had an IEP or a 504, that's where I'd be sending them. But this speaks to hiring and employment policies. We need to find ways to continue to attract and then retain excellent educators and other staff.
Thanks. Susan Wordsmith?
I really understand the frustration that parents go through. I've advocated for families and IEPs as well as been the teacher that's facilitating IEP meetings for a student in my care and fighting to make sure my students get what they need. It's not always easy as the teacher in different districts that I've worked in. Parents' knowledge of their child is key to creating the most effective individualized plan that will lead to success. They know their kids better than anyone. Several things that are absolutely necessary for an effective IEP meeting that will result in a workable instructional plan are the following. The use of valid and reliable screening assessments that I mentioned earlier to inform decision-making on instruction and interventions. Throwing out a standardized score, a RIT score that doesn't really tell us what the specific skills are doesn't help us in setting up a plan. Having educators present with expertise that can address the area the student needs help with. Sharing data with parents ahead of meetings, if is requested, in an understandable format so that parents are ready to ask questions at the meeting. If they're just dropped on at the meeting with that information, sometimes it's very hard for them to have solid questions about it. Allowing enough time to discuss each student and a plan of instruction. I've been in IEPs where it's like, we got 30 minutes. And it's like, well, 30 minutes isn't going to do it. So, you know, well, we'll come back.
Turn that off now.
Making sure parents are given the time to ask questions, to make sure they understand terminology, because, I mean, the terminology can get so thick. And making sure all service providers are involved in that IEP. It's the responsibility of the school district to guarantee a free, appropriate public education for each child. In order to do that, the IEP meeting needs to be a collaborative endeavor where all, including family caregivers, are involved, respected, and heard in the process. Thanks.
Thank you. Jacinta.
Yes. Parents know their children better than anybody. You know, parents have been watching their children since they were infants, watching them hit or miss developmental milestones, watching them struggle with sensory issues, watching them heroically face the day-to-day challenges of going to school with a disability. And we all, you know, a lot of us know when we bump up against the system, your kid is fine means your kid is fine because they're not causing us any trouble. Not that they're performing to the level of their ability and not that, you know, they don't need assistance. And parents know that. Parents know, we know what our kids are capable of just as intimately as we know what their challenges are. You know, I know what's frustrating is sometimes parents take time out of their day to go to the 504 IEP meeting and they're still not heard. And that's incredibly frustrating. I have a unique perspective because I was in the trenches with my own kid's 504 plan. I spent tons of time, tons of money, still didn't get one for her for about 7 years until we moved to California. And then I began to understand that the resistance was just slightly one of culture and school district, but far more one of budget and staffing. And so that's what kind of made me understand that systemic fixes include training and staffing and making the choice to make it a budget priority. And so those are some of the systemic fixes that I would offer, mostly in terms of staffing.
Thank you. Andy.
Thank you. I don't have a lot to add in terms of systemic fixes to what Susan laid out. I think she's got great experience for that. And I don't have a lot of experience with that. My family's experience, not only my mom and brother, but also my nephew who had an IEP, and also a cousin for whom I'll become a trustee when his parents pass away, as a special education student as well. So I just know that this is a critical issue for parents and students. It's critical that the IEP process and educational teams find a way to include these students in all the activities where it makes sense. And parents, I'll echo what was just mentioned, is that parents are a key stakeholder and knowledge base for what makes sense for their particular kid. The nature of the IDEA appreciated that students are actually individuals and not a large bucket of just students with disabilities. They're individuals with individual needs. And I think from a district level, we just need to continually ask, are we using this IEP process as well as we possibly can? Do we have a continuous improvement model in place? And is that model functioning well?
Sorry, thank you for that. Barry? Is he here? We can go on to Rima.
Yeah. Hello?
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry about that.
Go ahead, yeah. Barry.
I'm sorry about that. I like the idea of developing a parent rating scale where they fill out a scale twice a year, maybe after an IEP, and what their satisfaction level is with the support and services their children are getting, and how they feel supported by staff. I think this rating scale could be very effective. As a clinical social worker and school social worker for 23 years, I took great pride not only in doing everything I could to help special ed students and regular ed students, but working very hard to develop a very empathic, positive relationship with parents. It's really a great obligation to anybody involved with special ed. I saw wonderful teacher consultants doing the same. But I think it's a very important role is the relationship and sensitivity we have to parents. And I think this rating scale twice a year could be effective. You know, when I was in IEPs, one of the things you have to be concerned about is you cannot have 8 school personnel in an IEP with 1 or 2 parents or guardians because they feel overwhelmed, they feel intimidated. So we would purposefully try to limit the size of the staff. Depending on how many of the family were attending the IEP. As far as the legal issue, I've been in very contentious, difficult IEP situations where the school district had a lawyer and the parents had a lawyer, but that is a pretty low incidence occurrence. I mean, a far greater majority, I believe, parents feel typically supported. Sometimes they don't, and if they don't, then it's up to whoever's mainly involved, whether it be the teacher, consultant, social worker, psychologist, to change that relationship with the parent. We need to do everything we can to support them and feel that their children are getting the services and supports that they want. So I like the idea of a rating scale twice a year.
Thanks. Thanks. To you, yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm a strong advocate for building a better relationship with all members of the community, and that includes family, students, teachers, and staffs. And we need input from these members, and there has to be multiple modes of input. So this advisory group is wonderful, and we could add to that by having more outreaches, focus groups, school visits from trustees, phone calls, and other methods just to make sure that we can include all the voices. It is crucial to foster that community input so that the community feels this inclusiveness, transparency, and part of the decision-making process. Also providing training, professional development to teachers, staff. So just about special educations and IEP and process. But also families. I am one that was undiagnosed as a child for a very long time until one of my amazing elementary teacher brought this up to my parents and educated them about my disability. So that was very, very important that we do educate the families that aren't aware of this. And then, of course, this give the tools and the time for teachers to be able to identify kids that are struggling, and then ensure consistencies with the process and implementation of the process throughout the district, and obtain feedback regularly and implement continuous monitoring and evaluation of the IEP process and special education programs. Thank you.
Thanks.
Jeremy. Yes. So it's incredibly stigmatizing being a parent of a student with special education needs, especially when you self-advocate. It's seen as adversarial oftentimes. You responded with a sort of a pedantic approach. It's incredibly frustrating. So having done a lot of advocacy for my own kids and even for myself when I was in college, it's hard. You recognize the constraints of limited resources, being pulled in different directions for all the different needs. We've piled more and more work on teachers. We've piled more and more work on the parapros and the teachers' assistants, and we haven't really given them adequate time to keep up to date. So things like I've heard tonight, Alex talking about self-advocacy and inclusion, Jacinda talking about funding, Susan talking about needing an evidence base. These are all things I recognize and I've encountered. It's just really hard. I even wrote my own son's IEP plan. I was told, we can't do that. It's not part of the selected picked things that you can choose from. It's like it's an IEP only within these certain constraints. And I know that part of that's within the guidelines of the federal systems, but we need to do something that allows parents who are the experts on their kids to have a better voice. Other things I think we could do, weighted funding formulas, so schools with higher needs could get a higher percentage of the money. SEL programs that include neurodiversity perspectives and a way to disseminate the evidence base. So we have a lot of BCBAs and ABA practitioners. That's no longer considered the best evidence program. So we need to offer other sort of alternative approaches or complementary approaches. They're not the end all be all. They have a hegemony on the system. It's helpful for some students, but for the majority of students, it's been proven to be harmful and stigmatizing. So those are some of the things I'd look into, things from the speech language pathologist, neurodiversity perspective group, autistic self-advocacy network. We need to look at people who are actually autistic, who are actually disabled, and have them have a voice in how we develop our policies. So those are some of the things I would encourage us to do. And that's all I have to say about that. Thanks.
I'm gonna you off there. Yeah. Thanks. All right, Lena, to you.
Now, this is such a hard and sometimes difficult area. I've yet to meet a parent or caregiver who did not enter the IEP process in the spirit of collaboration and hope for a great inclusive education for their child. And then, as so many say, once you get into the process, it can feel more like a legal negotiation because of all the restrictions. And parents, not being savvy, not knowing as much as the people across the table from them, can feel very confused and just generally fearful through the process. They're the exact opposite of what we want. I've spoken to parents who say that they're sometimes afraid to really say what's on their minds, what's really concerning them, because they are worried that that it's going to be denied, or that there could be some type of punitive consequence. Their kid could be switched to another school. It's scary. One area I would love to see our district look at is look outside education, even to what other industries and government bodies use in situations like this, where there can be conflict between the two sides. One thing that many use is an independent ombudsman's office. It's a way for people to not have to do it as a legal process, but to have an independent body that they can raise concerns with, sometimes even anonymously. It would help IEP families, and it would help the district because they could learn about issues that might be happening in their special education process at an earlier stage. Harvard Business Review once wrote that one lawsuit avoided can pay for the whole ombudsman's office many times over.
I want to say cut you off there. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Thanks. Jamila.
Hi. So this question kind of came up on Facebook, so I answered it a little bit. So I'm going to be stealing some of my own answers from that. First, I would like to begin by saying, as a parent, all my children have had IEPs for one thing or another. All my children have had different things going on. And I know earlier the conversation was about intersectionality, but you know, that comes really into play with these IEPs. I think the first and foremost important thing is to make sure that our parents are, we our parents are educated in what the laws are, what our rights are, so we can be an advocate for ourselves. One of them being, I know that at each IEP I go to for each different child, I kind of get a book at the IEP, but I don't know any of this stuff beforehand. It can be very intimidating if it's your first time ever going through an IEP and having all these people just telling you all this stuff about your kid, but not really being heard or listened to about what you have to say about your kid. So it's so important that parents are not only educated about what their laws, what the laws and what their rights are, but parents are actually listened to and heard. It's easy for officials, rather intentionally or unintentionally, to poo-poo parents and kind of blow them off at what they're saying or what they're seeing, and like take the attitude like I know best or whatever. So it's very important that you are including these parents and listening to these parents about what's going on with them. It's also helpful if they, I think it's very helpful having an advocate. When my children were younger, I didn't know about the Student Advocacy Center who could come in and sit through an IEP with you, but I did work, have a community center person that at a community center my kids were going to that came in and helped advocate. And they've been through enough of those IEPs that they were kind of like experts. I think we find, as I said earlier, to incorporate IEP things in everyday classes, everyday works. I think it's very important that we are making sure that teachers get the support and the training that they need. Sometimes it is not unusual for a teacher to kind of be thrown into a situation and not be informed. The communication between the administration, the teachers, the principal, and the parents. And also asking the parents what it is that they need for support. Asking the
kids what it is they need for support. Jamila, thank you.
Sorry, sweetheart.
Thank you. And we'll go to Susan Baskett. Thanks.
Thank you. As a longtime trustee, I've heard from parents, families, and students about their experiences. And I reviewed those experiences with the superintendent and let her address those. I'm not a special education expert, but people do know my experiences. I've received special ed services as a child. I had a son who was denied special education services for his reading, and I parented a child who got the full gamut of special education in our district and did quite well. I am an expert in crisis management. That's what I know best. And so from my experience, having served again as an advocate, an unpaid advocate for families during IEPs, I offer the following suggestions for a better collaboration relationship with parents to achieve the best outcomes for our students. First, continue to acknowledge that the parents or caregivers are the primary educators in a child's life. Continue to acknowledge experiences as expertise of the educational team, and to continue to acknowledge the possibilities of biases. We also have to acknowledge that the IEP is to help the child learn and grow in the least restrictive environment, which may require changes on everyone's part. Continue to encourage the parent and caregiver to develop support networks outside of their family, like the PAC, for a broader perspective on things. And again, continue to document everything, the who, what, where, why, and how. clarify the purpose of the IEP in supporting students again in the least restrictive environment and to manage expectations, as well as help parents and caregivers understand their rights and responsibilities. Again, that's where the PAC helps, and ensure that the IEP can be understood by non-special education people as well. Very important for a better relationship building. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we have gone through all three of our questions from all of our candidates. And we still have technically about 15 minutes left in our meeting time, which we didn't expect to have. So yay, we were efficient. but I wanna, I guess, open it up to if anybody who's in the audience wants to ask a question, we could probably take one or two. And you're welcome also to put it in the chat if you don't wanna unmute and ask it directly. Maybe while people are thinking of questions they'd like to ask, I want to thank everybody for showing up and spending time with us. It's just really helpful to know that you're listening to us as parents, as a particular sort of interest group. It looks like Vijay Santi had asked a question earlier, and I am scrolling. So we have a question in the chat. You may have already read it. But it says, before the pandemic, it was obvious there were not enough resources or staffing for special education in the district. The state of Michigan received $6.2 billion from the federal government's COVID relief fund. Do you know how much money the Ann Arbor School District received? And how would you disperse funds to ensure that there is equitable access to a free and public education for special ed students? How would you ensure that special education students will be able to catch up for those who still have time before graduation? So it's sort of a question, it's sort of maybe a what do we do with the mess that COVID left us with the money that has been made available. So if candidates want to answer, maybe raise a hand, I'll call on you, and I'll give you about 2 minutes. Oh, go ahead, Jeremy.
Sure. Like, this goes back to the need for weighted funding formula. So we need to look at being nimble with our budgets in terms of like giving extra dollars to those schools that have the higher needs for whether that's special education or whatever the need is. Sorry, I got kids in the background. But that's going to take advocacy at the state level. So it's something that the board could do in terms of finding wiggle room in the operational budget. For instance, I've talked about using the savings from the electrification of our schools and the greening of our schools to be able to find more room to train personnel in within the district. But it's really going to take some reform at the state level. And I think that's something that we could do as school boards, using that sort of platform to work with other school boards to do the necessary advocacy at the state level. So that's one recommendation I would have. Thanks.
Thank you. Go ahead, Leslie. Leslie and then Jamila.
Yeah, thanks. The staffing is where the funding, I would like to see the funding go. I echo Jeremy's suggestion as to proportioning out to different schools that have more need for it than others, making sure that it's not just equality for that funding, but actual equity for those schools that need it. But the parapros and other support staff that need those extra dollars, that's where I'd put it.
Thank you. Jamila, and then Susan Schmidt, and then Susan Basket.
Could you read the question again? I want to make sure I actually answer the question.
Yeah, I don't want to read it word for word. It was pretty long, but it's sort of given the mess that COVID left us and the money that the federal government gave us in relief funds, sort of what would you do to sort of catch up or ensure special ed students can sort of recover as much as possible.
First off, I can't remember the exact number. I know the MEJC had, if you asked me earlier in the year, I would know the exact dollar that we got in Ann Arbor. However, I know that we haven't spent it. I know that a lot of that money is still sitting there in a pot. That money can be used to help with the tutoring and help with the support that's needed to catch our kids up. And I know a lot of people aren't really fans of this idea, but our kids missed a lot of school, and it would be nice if they could go do some summer school or do some alternative learning programs to help them catch up. Because if the concern is about them catching up, then that's what's going to need to be done. If the concern is just about taking them where they are right now and just going from there, recognizing that so many kids are behind and that COVID is a rare thing. So, well, a pandemic only happens every 100 years, and recognize that they're just missed it and that it's going to be okay. The whole world is affected. It's not going to hurt them that much. Then we'll be fine, but it doesn't change the fact that they need the support. And we have the money right now. That's not about the general fund that takes away from teacher salaries. That's not about the cushion fund that we have for a rainy day. We have the money. I'm just kind of confused why we're not utilizing it in a way that's to help support our kids regain this knowledge or get to a level where they're confident. And it is definitely about an equitable thing. I totally agree with Jeremy when he's talking about the way funding should always go towards who needs, not equality and who wants. And it's about our babies, so doing the best that we can. But we have, again, where there's a will, there's a way. We have the funds. We have the resources. We're just not doing it.
Thank you. Susan Schmidt?
I think historically, we know special ed, as far as federal funding, has always been short. And I think that's been a frustration. I served on the East Lansing School Board, and it was always so difficult to deal with that. We knew what we needed to do for our children on IEPs, but we knew that the feds were not covering all those expenses. Currently, there are things that we need to do to not just help the kids on IEPs, but all the kids that are affected by interrupted learning. Because if we don't, we're going to end up with kids that are going to end up on IEPs that probably never needed to be. And so some things have happened. I've worked on the state level. There's $10 million in our K-12 budget this year from the state for special literacy training, for instance, that teachers have access to. And I know there's a number of people in the Ann Arbor district that have signed up for this, mostly coaches. I want to see frontline teachers signing up for this. But I wish that we could say what we could do would happen like immediately, but there are some things that the monies that have to equip teachers to really be able to deal with some of these deficits and the delay in what our children experienced, especially our youngest, because during virtual learning, when children are just learning to read and they're learning to write their letters and they're figuring out sound symbol, if that is messed with, it really has horrific outcomes. So, I mean, we need to look at this money in teacher training, definitely how we recruit and retain teachers, but part of that retention is we've got to continue to help them grow professionally so they want to stay here. It's a very complex issue. I don't know as much about, I need to know more about what has come into the district. I really can't speak to details because I don't have all that information. When I have that information if I'm elected to the school board, I know that my voice will be strong for those children that have special needs, because those are the kids I've been advocating for always, and will continue to do so.
Thanks. So we're going to go Rima, Lena, Alex. Go ahead.
Yeah, I echo a lot of the comments that have been said. We definitely need to increase staffing and increase support, such as the paraprofessionals. We really need to focus on professional development and education, and a lot for like the teachers, the staff, to be able to identify some of the things that has been said that maybe are being left unnoticed. And then the biggest thing is addressing the burnout and retention in special education teachers. It's in all teachers, but especially with the special education teachers. So we need to look at You know, how do we provide more time? How do we provide more support, more manageable schedules? So I think, you know, without addressing that, you know, it's going to cause further problems. Thank you.
Thanks. Go ahead, Lena. Oh, you're muted.
Apologies for that. I was actually hopping on the website. AAPS has a section of their website, and I'm struggling to bring it up right now, where they discuss how their pandemic spending was spent and what money came into the district. But as we can tell, we have a whole slate of candidates here, and all of us are somewhat at a loss on like exactly what the member asked about. How much money is our district getting and how have we spent it? We need to do a better job communicating that. One of the things I've learned from watching numerous board meetings is that it's very restricted on exactly what we can spend the money on. We can't always spend it exactly the way we want to spend it. But we also have started the pandemic with wonderful resources in a tech bond and facilities bond. When this new money came in, a lot of the board members explained that part of the money would go to sort of reimbursing money that the district had already spent, like the $10 million spent on technology. And I keep hearing from parents in the district and special ed parents and that, you know, what they really want is in-person tutoring, more summer school. Summer school for younger kids last summer was 10 days or 9 days and by invitation only at one school without busing. You know, we need to, as board members, make it a lot clearer to the community on how, what this money is and how we're spending it, because people have questions and they're right to have questions about this.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Susan Baskett had her hand up and I skipped her. So we're going to go Susan and then to Alex and Andy.
That's fine. Thank you. I appreciate that. First of all, I'm going to call foul. Board members, as any elected, should not be expected to pull out a line item out of a $295 million budget. So our reports are online. They are transparent in terms of monies. I just wanted to, and I will say for me personally, I do not give out dollar amounts without verification. So I'm very careful to, again, not give out dollar amounts because what if I'm wrong? And sometimes that does happen. I'm human. So what I can promise is to address the question, get back and address the question. But I do want to understand the question. Is the questioner asking about the money that we've received in terms of special education or total COVID dollars? And that's the biggie, I guess. And how would you like us to, or me to communicate that answer? Would that be back through you, Ms. Wright, or?
Yeah, what we could do if Vijay, I think it was you who asked the question, if you wanted to clarify more, that is something we can follow up with by putting it on our website, circulating the question again, and then putting answers onto our website.
I just want to stress that our reports are online. And if anyone has any problems finding something, which it could happen, give us a call, either as trustees or our support staff at Ballas. And Ms. Osinski would be very glad to help you find that report and send it to you if necessary. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, so we'll go to Alex and then Andy, and then we have one more question that we could go through. Oh, hold on, Alex, you're muted.
Thanks. I want to say that Susan Baskett is right. I've looked up what the ESSER funding was that came to our schools myself. It's definitely on the school's website. I can't speak to what money is left over, but I'd like to remind people that the pandemic is not over. And if there is money left from our COVID funding, I'd like to see it spent on COVID protections. There are literally hundreds of families in our school who can't access their IEPs. Families like mine, my twins cannot access their IEP because I cannot send them safely in person because the school chose to completely abandon any COVID precautions for this year. So we lost our spot in Head Start. I cannot access their continued speech therapy through their IEP that would have continued from early on. And like, that's a real hardship for my family, right? My daughter went to kindergarten by choice. We chose to do the virtual school. We're choosing to do it again for first grade. And I can't use an IEP there. Like, she needs added supports. And I can't even have one. I'm not the only family like this. I facilitate a peer support group for disabled families, high-risk families in Washtenaw County. I have over 100 families, just like mine, who have either made the hard choice to send their children one-way masking in school and just hope for the best, hope for that they don't end up significantly ill, or they've made choices like mine, which is a privileged choice. I want to point out that I am able to stay home and facilitate virtual learning for my daughter, but it's hard. I'd like to see us using any COVID money we have to implement a comprehensive, equitable COVID safety plan so that all of our families can access in-person learning if that's what they want.
Thank you. Perfectly timed to 2 minutes. We'll go to Andy. Thank you.
I just wanted to communicate a couple of things. One has been mentioned, at least alluded to by some of the others, which is that money, be nice if sometimes the government would just drop money and say, you know, do whatever you want with it. But this came with strings attached, a lot of it. But more importantly, I do agree with the questioner, or I think it was the same person in the chat who was referring to the fact of, you know, philosophically, should we use the money that we have, independent whether it's COVID or otherwise, should we use it now or should we wait and save it for a rainy day? I think we need to, philosophically, I'm aligned with the idea, we use it now for the people who are in school now and have the need now. I don't like the idea of running huge ongoing surpluses. I'm not saying we're doing that. We're not really doing that on an ongoing basis with huge deficits on a percentage basis. I'm just saying philosophically, I'm aligned with the questioner.
Thank you. Okay, we had another question in our chat, which came from Alana. I'm saying your name right. And she says, the largest barrier we have experienced has not been around the IEP process, but around teacher education around neurodiversity. The IEP has offered wonderful support, but it has not been enough to counter the lack of support his teachers were provided from a training perspective. How can we better support our teachers so that they best partner with our children? Anybody like to answer? Go ahead. I see Jamila first, and then we'll go to Jeremy and Andy. I don't know if your hand is still up or up again, but you can make a decision. Go ahead, Jamila.
So I think the biggest obstacle for real for us is the stigmatization that goes with being special education and recognizing that special education isn't just the physical disabilities, but the mental disabilities such as the ADHD and the autism, and how they're often mistaken as being problem children simply because they are not following the trend of being obedient little learners. So that's one thing. And that has to be a cultural change, because although a lot of it is about training and the teachers being aware of these things, but we have to recognize that mental health has been so stigmatized in the past, and a lot of these teachers have been teachers for a really long time, that they're kind of biased towards it and kind of throw it off. And that's not to say that teachers don't care about it and that teachers are in it to win it, but this is just what they were taught before. So it is about training. It is about, but it's also about changing hearts and minds and actually changing your perspective and your views on these things. Because sometimes, because we are all human, having this human experiences, our bias is put in and we don't take a deep breath and pause when we see a child that's acting out emotionally or fidgeting around or whatever. And we kind of just blow them off or automatically go to discipline. And that's not really appropriate. So it's about training. It's about changing our biases and opening our hearts and minds and recognizing that we don't know everything and do have a lot to learn. And sometimes these things are really subtle. Even the parents can't see them right away or don't know what the problem is. So it's about us educating ourselves as well.
Thank you. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Sure. So this is an area I'm particularly interested in. I've done a lot of research on autistic self-advocacy. We really need to listen to autistic people. I think that was what the question was directed at. And listen to what they're asking for. I am not a fan of Autism Speaks. It's an ableist sort of approach. And we need to do a lot of unlearning. So I think everyone from Paulo Freire to Derek Ford have talked about unlearning, and we need to do a lot of unlearning in our institutions. We know that, you know, systems of oppression are individual, they're institutional, they're societal, and they have effects on people. We have a lot of unconscious bias, particularly around ableism, and we need to do work to unlearn ableist perspectives. I don't know exactly how that will happen, but it's what's needed. And as a board member, I would support any sort of socio-emotional learning that would both look at the, for lack of a better term, the oppressed as well as the oppressor. I'm not saying teachers or anybody's an oppressor, but like that's sort of what that framework would entail is looking at how can we unlearn the systems, the unconscious biases we have when we are bringing those to the classroom, interacting with neurodivergent students. Thanks.
Thank you. Susan Schmidt?
I think the question, I just want to make sure I've got the question. This is talking about how well-prepared teachers are to work with the students. Am I getting the question right?
The questioner is welcome to add more if they'd like. My reading about it was that teachers needed more training to be okay. able even to implement that.
Okay.
The support IEP.
Exactly. Yes, they do. Yes, they do. So I want to give you an example. So I was trained in 1998-99 at the Michigan Dyslexia Institute. It was a life-changing experience for me. I realized, and here I had a master's degree in learning disabilities, and they didn't teach us basically how to truly teach a child to read, especially a child that had characteristics of dyslexia or just a difficult time. It changed the trajectory of my career. It changed everything for me and my students. So when I worked at Scarlett, it was a great experience. I mean, the successes were just, I've taught in Lansing schools, but when I was at Scarlett, that was my last 4 years. Currently, exciting enough, there's $1 million in the state monies where teachers can access training like this. Teachers at Scarlett, six of them, special ed, I think there's some Title I in there, are taking this training. I'm at the trainings working with the Michigan Dyslexia Institute to sort of be an assistant and then to help later with the bridge to practice. I can only tell you, you watch these teachers in this training, and these are not necessarily beginning teachers. These are people that have been working for 15 years in the classroom. The excitement when you give teachers relevant training that will really change their practice so they can help kids. So I think it's really important that the district needs to continue to look at relevant training that will really make a difference. And we know what the science says about teaching reading. I know that the science says different things about different areas of the types of children that we're trying to help. But we must not, we just can't waste time on professional learning that's not relevant and that doesn't really change the need, move the needle. And if you give teachers what they need, they're excited about it. And I can tell you as a teacher, there's lots of professional learning we've been through that we just roll our eyes and it's like, oh, here we go again. But we need to really make sure that we're doing right by the teachers in the district because they will do better by our children.
Thanks. Okay, Andy, I'm going to go to you.
I think there is a huge amount of wisdom in the way the question was framed. It was framed, how can we better support our teachers so they can best partner with our students? And I think that really resonated with me because my dad and brother, as superintendents over the years, the decades, have seen that when step changes in progress are made, it's almost always coming out of a situation where teachers and parents are aligned on goals. So I think that's an incredibly wise way to frame it. Most teachers are lifelong learners. They love to learn and they love to teach. Certainly would not argue with what Susan called out about the huge amount of training teachers already do, but I believe that teachers here in Ann Arbor would be very much open to learning for these particular students, because they often are drawn to those that have the needs that are, you know, most I would say, like, you know, the people that have the biggest needs, and many of those are students with IEPs and 504s. Thank you.
Thanks. If anybody else would like to answer, you're welcome to. Yeah, go ahead, Alex. You're still muted. Hold
my on. Little hand, I think, blends in with my background. So I have an ADHD diagnosis, and if I had a dollar for every person at school who said to me, well, you're just not applying yourself, I could have paid for college, like, outright. And in my work with families over the years, I don't think that's really changed. It's one of those things where if you aren't neurodivergent yourself, there's a lot of, like, cultural aspects of it that really people miss and don't account for. And that's not teachers' faults. It's just a matter of education. I know I talked about my colleague earlier that works at U of M and focuses on disability justice studies. They are actually autistic themselves. And this is a real passion of theirs in supporting the neurodivergent community and helping other people learn how best to support us. And I know they would love to come and do workshops with our teachers, with our administration. So I already have someone lined up to really facilitate that process in our schools.
Thank you. It is 8:39 by my clock. I think we've done a lot. We've put our candidates through the ringer. So thank you for sticking with us. Unless there are any final thoughts, I will close it and just remind everybody to vote on November 8th or before. I have my ballot in my desk right now.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody. Have a nice evening.